You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Georgina Godwin, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we talk to the veteran US journalist Tom O'Hara about the decision of the national newspaper's editor Hassan Fathah to step down. Has the dream of creating Abu Dhabi's version of the New York Times or the FT failed?
I mean, I've worked at the 8 newspapers in my time, and I've never worked at one that was so chaotic and so rancorous. Really.
James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Paris, joins us to set the day's agenda. What do you have for us today, James?
A day of tragedy is expected in Lampedusa as drowned Eritrean and Somali refugees are plucked from the water. The Nigerian military takes the attack to the Islamist militant group Boko Haram by reportedly bombing their camps in the northeast of the country. And Qatar steps up its support for the embattled regime in Sudan.
Thanks very much, James. Looking forward to those stories, if you can call it looking forward. Something a little bit lighter, a new social history of British television hits the bookshelves this week. It's called Armchair Nation. And if you snuggle up here next to us, the author Jo Moran will be talking us through it.
We'll also get the latest discussion topics from our man in Istanbul. And on the preview of this week's food and drinks programme, The Menu, we head to Santiago to tour the city's spectacular food markets.
So basically, I just ordered a fried merluza with papamayo, which is essentially a potato salad. And the interesting thing is the price. It's only 2,000 pesos, $4. And that's hard to beat no matter where you go.
All that, plus we'll be spinning some tunes too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
An Italian Senate committee is to begin discussion of whether to expel Silvio Berlusconi from Parliament. The discussion follows his abandoned attempt to topple Italy's coalition government, which failed when members of his own party refused to back him. Mr. Berlusconi was sentenced to 4 years in prison for tax fraud. That was later commuted to 1 year under house arrest. Giovanni Ossina is a professor of contemporary history at Lewis University in Rome.
Berlusconi has lost any possibility of politically reversing that kind of decision or making those who vote against him pay for that decision. So he's weaker, and this is going to be very hard for him personally and also politically.
A day of national mourning is underway in Italy for the African migrants killed when their boat sank close to the island of Lampedusa. More than 100 bodies have been recovered from the water, but at least 200 other people are still missing. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel starts coalition talks today. Although she led her CDU party to its best election result in decades, she still needs at least one coalition partner. She's meeting leaders from the Social Democrats today and will hold talks with Germany's Greens next week. The US government shutdown continues for a fourth day, and it's forced President Obama to abandon plans for a visit to Asia. Instead, he will stay in Washington, D.C., trying to end the standoff over the federal budget. Mr. Obama has already warned that a bigger crisis could be triggered later this month when the U.S. government could run out of cash. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, warns that would have a global impact.
The ongoing political uncertainty over the budget, over the debt ceiling, does not help. The government shutdown is bad enough, but failure to raise the debt ceiling would be far worse and could very seriously damage not only the US economy, but also the entire global economy.
An investigation is underway after a high-speed chase through the center of Washington, D.C., which ended with a woman shot dead by police. She'd rammed her car into the gates of the White House, though it's not clear why. A one-year-old girl found inside the car is safe and well. It triggered a security alert in the heart of the U.S. Capitol.
Police were chasing the car, and after that I heard a boom, and I thought it was an accident. And after that there were two police standing in front of the Capitol, and they told people to leave immediately.
More than 20 warships from 17 countries have sailed into Sydney Harbour. More than a million people are expected to witness the International Fleet Review, which marks 100 years since the Royal Australian Navy first arrived in the city. On board one of those ships in 1913 was Kathleen Venn's father.
I feel like I could cry watching the ships come up, thinking that my father came here. That's how he came here, was on the ships. And he liked the place so much, he got married here and had five children. Imagine that I was probably the only one here today whose father actually came out on the ships. So I consider it a great honour.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Paul Osborne. We will see you again at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House and thanks very much for joining us. It's 6 minutes past the top of the hour. It's time now to set the day's news agenda. And joining us in the studio is James Schneider, who's editor of Think Africa Press. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks
James.
For having me.
James, Nigeria, terrible, terrible scenes going on there. Boko Haram, we've seen them target schools. Now it's a university. What's this fixation on Western education facilities?
This is one of the bases of the organization itself. The name Boko Haram, which isn't really its name, it's just what they're referred to as, means Western education is forbidden or something like that. And it dates back to the rejection of British colonialism in the north of Nigeria and seeing Western education as a tool for colonization. So likewise, the group Boko Haram view Western education and other kind of secular institutions as removing Islam from within their society, and so they attack it violently.
So tell us exactly what's actually happened over the last couple of days there.
So the Nigerian military have released some statements saying that they've taken fighter jets and they've gone and bombed alongside a ground assault on a Boko Haram camp in the forest quite close to the capital of the state where there was the most recent attack on the agricultural college that you mentioned. But it's really difficult to verify any of the facts or the figures because, one, there are no journalists there, and two, the government has quite a long record of doing something and then making a big song and dance about how they've killed X number of Boko Haram militants, but there's not that much evidence for it forthcoming.
The military are also making the point that the school attacks, which came in the middle of the night, as you say, the Islamists threw explosive and spread gunfire into those dormitories at the sleeping students. The military is saying that's really a sign of desperation, claiming they only have the capacity to hit soft targets, which won't be much comfort to the families of the victims. But
no,
is there some
truth
in that?
Well,
what does soft target mean, ultimately? I mean, where does it end?
There are a lot of soft targets, and predominantly Boko Haram has taken on soft targets. It tends to attack state institutions, police stations, army installments, and things like that, which that doesn't sound like a soft target, but basically a building in a town somewhere you walk in and you shoot, that's a soft target. The military are saying they probably don't have the capacity to pull off explosive events in the capital Abuja or elsewhere, which is probably the case at the moment. They have firmly retreated to the northeast of the country, which is where they're from. But it's contradictory from the military because they say on the one hand they're sort of defeated, but on the other hand they've got a state of emergency in three states, and they say that they've arrested 178, and they'd say that the numbers are pretty large. So it's a bit of both.
So should this be viewed in a local or in a transnational context?
Mainly local. There's an attempt to equate Boko Haram with Al-Qaeda, try to link them in with Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Shabaab and so on. But to really understand what they're about, you have to view them in their very specific local context. And any of the evidence that's presented for their links, any strong links to AQIM, are at this stage quite unsubstantiated.
Let's move over to Sudan and a completely different story. Now, Qatar has pledged $1 billion as budgetary support. They've agreed to deposit $1 billion into Sudan's central bank to support the economic reform measures and cover the balance of payments deficit. Mm. How significant is this?
Well, Sudan are trying to use this, and whether the money comes or not is slightly beside the point. They're trying to demonstrate that they've got support and they've got financial support. And Bashir, is the president, is trying to stop the slide on the black market for the Sudanese pound, which since the austerity measures were announced last week, it's fallen on the black market, you know, about 15%. And saying that there is external support helps to shore up this position. But also, given that Sudan is running out of money, which is why it's doing this, but it's not going to cut back on its security or military spending, having this kind of support from Qatar will help stabilize Bashir.
And it's running out of money because of its military spending.
Because of its military spending, and also because of the secession of the South, which took a lot of the oil with it. But yes, it is a country that spends most of its budget on warfare and internal warfare. And so there isn't much money left over for the kind of state subsidies for petrol and sugar and so on, which they were able to fund when they had the oil.
James, let's talk about a story that's covering, well, it's dominating the front pages in many of the newspapers today. More than 100 dead, presumably the death toll actually much higher than that, in this boat tragedy at the gates of Europe. These Eritrean and Somalian migrants, we think, who are coming from Libya to Lampedusa, just off Italy. I mean, this is just a blockbuster tragedy and catastrophe, but really indicative of a problem that has seen 20,000 people die in these waters over the past two decades. Migrants, I should say, die attempting to get them. And this is obviously a huge story, not just for Italy, but for all of Europe.
Yes, and the Italians are really trying to say this isn't an Italian issue, this is a European-wide issue, and trying to kind of broaden the response, saying that they can't be solely responsible for defending, a phrase I don't really like, but it's used, Fortress Europe. So that's how you have to view it in the European context. But also from the African side, there is these migrants, these economic refugees and asylum seekers are not going to stop coming whilst there is such a stark inequality between the conditions in one place and the other place. And it's interesting that they're trying to get to Italy, and it's from Somalia and Eritrea, two places which were under Italian colonial rule. And so there is a kind of, there is a degree of historical legacy, and also I think a degree of responsibility which both Europe has but also Italy. And I think the Pope was quite right in calling it a disgrace and trying to call attention to the ongoing problem back in July.
That seemed quite a kind of, sorry, Georgina, but that seemed quite a personal response. That was an impromptu remark that he made, having sent out this tweet. He, of course, visited Lampedusa last year and talked about the global indifference. And, you know, obviously hugely important to him. He's made such a big deal in his papacy of highlighting the plight of the world's poor and saying that more needs to be done. That was obviously a very personal response. Was that unexpected, do we think?
I think it falls into the general pattern of what he's tried to set out for his papacy. He has, exactly as you say, he's tried to place far more of an emphasis on the poor, on the weak, and so on. And I think he's trying to use his role to highlight the people who otherwise would not get highlighted. So last week or the week before, he was talking about the plight of the global unemployed, and now it's the migrant who you never see, who you would never see unless there's a tragedy and you're forced to see on the front of your newspaper.
Is there any appetite from the rest of Europe to try and stop this happening? I mean, as you point out, as long as there are problems like this in Eritrea, in Somalia, waves of people are going to keep on coming.
Well, judging by how France responded during the Arab Spring, I don't think so. France temporarily suspended the Schengen Agreement to close the border between Italy and France so that Tunisian and Libyan refugees couldn't get into their country. So I think the kind of pan-European solidarity, both for other members of the EU and for those outside it, is somewhat lacking at the moment.
And over 1,500 people were killed during the Arab Spring, drowned in the
crossing
waters.
Crossing the waters.
I mean, that's a huge number for a year. James, we're going to have to leave it there, very sadly. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press.
Coming up, as the editor of the national newspaper in Abu Dhabi stands down, we ask veteran US journalist Tom O'Hara whether the idea behind the newspaper has failed.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has a right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
Welcome back to Midori House, 17 minutes past the hour, and on to Abu Dhabi, where The National is experiencing changes in its editorial floor. The paper was created to be Abu Dhabi's version of a world-class newspaper, supposedly comparable to the New York Times or the Financial Times. Many of its staff joined the team from quality newspapers around the world. After 5 years, Hassan Fattah, formerly of the New York Times, has just stepped down as editor-in-chief. The deputy editor, Bob Cohen, will take on day-to-day editing responsibilities until a new editor-in-chief is appointed.
Despite being owned by the Abu Dhabi government, The National has long claimed to be a rarity in the Middle East, where media is tightly controlled. However, these high-level resignations on the editorial floor have raised questions. Monocle's news editor Steve Bloomfield spoke earlier to veteran journalist Tom O'Hara, who worked on the foreign desk at The National until last year.
Tom O'Hara, thank you very much for joining us. Hassan Fattah is leaving. The National was supposed to be, it was often talked about being Abu Dhabi's version of The Guardian or The New York Times. It hasn't quite worked out like that, has it?
No, it has not. There's too much government censorship and then a lot of newsroom self-censorship that, you know, make The National look anything like a high-standard Western newspaper.
And is part of the problem that, you know, perhaps too much has been expected of The National? And, you know, perhaps in a sense we should just be look at it and go, well, actually, you know, for what it is, it's a relatively high quality English language newspaper in the Gulf, and we should just accept it as that.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. Yeah, I think it's probably unrealistic, really, to expect a bunch of Westerners to land in Abu Dhabi, be given the reins of a large newspaper and expect it to function like The Guardian, because it's a monarchy. You know what I mean? It's not a democratic government there, you know? They're not accustomed to having their operations, their conversations, you know, revealed to the people they govern.
With Hassan Fattah's departure, I mean, does that suggest to you that he himself has failed and that the people that own the paper want to take it in a new direction? Or is it just, you know, well, he's been there 4 years and this is what happens?
Son was not a very skilled newsroom manager. He wasn't a very good editor. And I think he pandered successfully to people up the food chain, you know, for a while. But who knows? It was a difficult job, you know what I mean? He had to deal with basically the Emirati censors, I'm sure. And then he had to deal with a chronically unhappy newsroom. So maybe he just got tired of it all.
Well, you mentioned a chronically unhappy newsroom. I mean, lots of newsrooms around the world at the moment are pretty unhappy at newspapers anyhow. But I mean, this seemed to, you know, to go a bit further. You had the leaking of everyone's salary. You had a Facebook group made up allegedly of people who worked on staff all saying that the editor should go. How did the atmosphere get that poisonous?
It was a combination of the censorship. People would go out and find stories, and then you wouldn't be able to write them properly or get them published at all. Or, you know, there were many times where there were stories that were written, and then they were edited in such a ham-handed fashion to downplay anything that would reflect poorly on the government. You know, that's just dispiriting to writers and editors. Furthermore, it was chaotic in the newsroom. It was not terribly organized. There were shouting matches in the middle of the newsroom. I mean, I've worked at 8 newspapers in my time, and I've never worked at one that was so chaotic and so rancorous, really. Some of it was due to Hassan. He was ill-equipped, really, to be running a newsroom of that size with that many. There are a lot of sophisticated journalists there, and, you know, he had never edited a newspaper before, so he didn't have any idea what he was doing, basically.
Now, you were one of, you know, many Westerners who were brought over at the start of this project to not just to give it a certain sheen, but to also, you know, bring certain news values, supposedly. Do you think that, you know, there still needs to be that steady stream of Westerners going over to the National if it wants to, you know, continue to try and punch above its weight?
Yeah, it's going to need a steady stream of Canadians, Australians, Americans, Brits, you know, Irishmen, because, you know, basically, you know, we're trained in quality mainstream journalism. So, I mean, if they want to maintain even what they've got, they're going to need a steady stream. And I think they'll get it because, you know, they pay a nice salary. There's no taxes. You know, it's not a bad place to live, you know, so. And, of course, obviously, the journalism business in the Western world is in bad shape. So I don't think they'll have any problem getting. But there is enormous turnover there, you know, because, you know, it's not a particularly happy or satisfying place to work.
Just finally as well, I mean, do you think that the, you know, when you look at the international influx into the paper, and obviously a lot of the criticism has all been in the international press, did you find that actually people in Abu Dhabi were on the whole quite supportive of the paper?
You know, yeah, it was difficult to tell even how many people even read the newspaper. I would have to assume, I believe that many of the expats who read it, it was far better than anything else they were going to get. You know what I mean? It provided good sports coverage, and there was a lot of entertainment coverage, and, you know, things that were non-controversial, you know, it provided a lot of good information for people who are living there. Do they support it? I think they supported it with the understanding that, you know, you were never going to get any sort of investigative or truly quality explanatory journalism out of it.
That was US journalist Tom O'Hara, formerly on the foreign desk at The National, speaking to Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. The time is 8:24 here in London, 10:24 in Istanbul, which is where we're heading now to speak to our man there, Joseph Dana. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning from a very overcast Istanbul.
Well, it's pretty overcast in London, you won't be surprised to hear. Lovely to have you on the show, as always. We've got loads to talk about this morning. So should we kick things off with China and the expansion of its role in the wider Middle East, looking at the fact that Turkey is highly likely to sign this missile deal with Chinese in 6 months? Tell us more.
Absolutely. The Chinese have had a very busy week in the Middle East this week. It started with a Chinese businessman giving about $160 million to an Israeli university in an unprecedented gift to Israel's kind of technological community. And it's continued with news that Turkey will likely sign a deal with a Chinese defense firm worth $3.4 billion to co-produce a long-range missile defense system. Now, this comes at a very interesting time in the region, and it looks like the deal is kind of upsetting the Americans because of the role of NATO in Turkey. And so they're worried that that this firm that they're dealing with, this Chinese firm, might have a bit of a, let's say, verbose past in which they've dealt with Iran, North Korea, and Syria, and that these missile defense systems might share some NATO defense system kind of secrets and things like that. So it's a very, very controversial deal that the Turks are about to embark on.
Why announce a deal and then not implement it for 6 months?
I believe that, you know, Turkish foreign policy, especially when it comes to defense, it's a very interesting dance that they're playing all over the world, especially in the Middle East, in which they kind of test the waters with certain things, and then depending on the reaction, they kind of step back and, you know, cancel deals or change them around. And so Turkey's really sending a message probably directly to the United States because of its, you know, kind of differing takes on how the Syria crisis should be handled. You know, the Turks are basically saying, look, we're very interested in creating a very elaborate missile defense system because we're so worried about what's going on in Syria. And if you're not willing to take, you know, as strong of an action in Syria as we would like, maybe we'll just go with the Chinese, you know, and we'll kind of test the waters there. And so this deal could fall through, but the fact that the Chinese are so interested in getting their foothold on that Syrian border in Turkey is very interesting.
And moreover, the Chinese company placed the lowest bid, we should point out, $3.44 billion for the tender against higher ones from Russia and the US and Europe. Is it remotely legitimate for the US to be throwing their toys out the pram, as it were, to be kicking up such a fuss and almost maligning Turkey in terms of it saying that, you know, it shouldn't be doing this because of the sanctions? It's suggesting that Turkey might leak technological know-how to China because of this deal. Is that in any way valid?
Well, it's definitely a card that the Americans have to play. Let's keep in mind that the United States has a very, very tenuous grip on what's going on vis-a-vis how its allies are understanding the Syria crisis. Israel has been very, very forceful in demanding American action in Syria, and Turkey has been very, very forceful as well. And then we have this wild card, the Chinese, which the Israelis and the Turks are both kind of playing at this point. And so I think that if there's continued row between Turkey, Israel, and the United States, the Chinese will definitely jump in and try and take advantage of that. And the, you know, the Turks and the Israelis also have that card to play. And so, you know, the Americans have a lot of very, very deep issues to deal with in the region right now. And so we'll see if this is one of the issues that they're really going to try and, you know, solve, as it were, and try and, you know, mend some of the very delicate friendships that it has with its allies in the region.
Joseph, let's move on to Gezi Park. Amnesty International has come out with a serious report on the human rights violations involved with the Gezi Park protests. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Amnesty International released a very damning report, basically arguing that Turkey did not respect the right to peaceful assembly during the Gezi Park protests. It also addressed the fact that the democratization package that Erdogan has presented really failed to address some of these Gezi Park violations. You know, 8,000 people injured, the kind of arbitrary arrest that was going on, the impunity for the police. And this is just another, it kind of underlines how dangerous and volatile these protests can be. I've seen protests like this, like the Gezi Park protests, from Egypt to Palestine, and they're not very fun to be in. And so you see really kind of the police getting very heated and getting kind of hot-headed, and that comes out against protesters. And we're seeing Amnesty International very correctly identify these abuses, and it underlines the fact that if you're going to have these types of protests in a massive urban area like Istanbul, there are going to be ramifications. And so we'll see how the Turks, or at least the Turkish government, responds to this report if and when the Gezi Park protests return to the streets.
Joseph Dana, our man in Istanbul, thank you very much indeed. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be talking television consumption in Armchair Britain and food consumption in the markets of Santiago, Chile.
So basically, I just ordered a fried merluza with papa mayo, which is essentially a potato salad. And the interesting thing is the price. It's only 2,000 pesos, $4. And that's hard to beat no matter where you go.
Delicious. We'll also be reviewing the front pages with Monocle's Thomas Lewis. But first of all, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
An Italian Senate committee begins a discussion today on whether to expel Silvio Berlusconi from Parliament. That follows his abandoned attempt to topple the Italian coalition government, which failed when members of his own party refused to back him. In Italy, it's a day of national mourning for the African migrants who were killed when their boat sank close to the island of Lampedusa. More than 100 bodies have been recovered from the water, but at least 200 others are still missing. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel is starting coalition talks today. She led her CDU party to its best election result in decades, but still needs at least one coalition partner. Today she meets leaders from the Social Democrats. She's also due to hold talks with Germany's Green Party. An investigation's continuing after a high-speed chase through the centre of Washington, D.C., which ended with a woman shot dead by police. She'd rammed her car into the gates of the White House, though it's still not clear why. And the U.S. government shutdown is continuing for a fourth day. It's forced President Obama to abandon plans for a visit to Asia. Instead, he's to stay in Washington, D.C., where he'll try to end the standoff over the federal budget. Mr. Obama's already warned that a bigger crisis could be triggered later this month, when the U.S. government may run out of cash to pay its bills. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Paul Osborne. We'll see you again at the top of the hour. Meanwhile, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Georgina Godwin.
As consumers increasingly seek to connect with the source of their food, eating at markets has grown in popularity over recent years. Always keen to find out what the locals are selling around the world, we sent our Chile correspondent, Steve Bodson, to Santiago's market district, where stands sell fresh produce and discount groceries. We're not talking the sorts of gourmet markets of Europe and North America, where you might buy a $2 tomato. In Santiago, that's enough to buy 4 kilos of tomatoes.
But despite it having some of the cheapest prices around, it's still becoming an increasingly popular place for diners, including some upscale tourists who are looking for the genuine flavours of chili. Spoilt for choice, Steve took a tour of the many eateries and began with lunch at Santiago's newest market with Colin Bennett, who's organising food tours in Chile's capital.
You'd be hard-pressed to find such an eclectic mix of smells in Santiago, just because there is a real diversity of the stalls that have been set up here. There's a lot of course, Chilean food, but then there are also a lot of Peruvians. You know, the center of Santiago is kind of a center point for the Peruvian immigrant community, so tons of stands for Peruvian food. And then you also have these other arrivals that are just kind of different. You have Colombian food. There's a Mexican stand over there. There's kind of some international. There's a guy who probably has gotten the most press. His name is Juanito Hoyas, and he was the executive chef of Chile's embassy in Italy. So he's cooked for presidents, and he cooks a kind of international blend of different stuff from all over Latin America and beyond. I think there are 2 Thai places here, and with real, I mean, not just some Chilean that went to Bangkok and came back and got inspired, but rather actual, you know, Thai immigrants that have set up shops here.
Colin takes me upstairs from the produce market to the eateries area. It's a big platform with a roof. The walls are open to the breeze. There are dozens and dozens of tiny eateries here, each with maybe 5 tables and a little open kitchen. As soon as we get to the top of the stairs, we start getting the pitches. I see tourists in Gore-Tex raincoats, vendors whose hands are thick from pushing half-ton carts, and clumps of office workers in silk ties.
This is the famous Juanito Hoyas. There's a whole like line of guys in suits that are waiting to sit down and get some food. That's something interesting, you know. That's necessarily wouldn't expect that for the market.
We settle in at a Chilean food stand run by Colombian immigrants. Colin orders merluza, or Austral hake, with a bunch of side orders.
So basically, I just ordered a fried merluza with papamayo, which is essentially a potato salad, ensalada chilena next to it. That's sliced tomatoes with onion and some hot pepper on top. You know, I'll probably pour some vinegar and some oil on there as well, a bit of salt. It'll also come with a ceviche entrada, so a ceviche starter, and we get some soft drink on the side. No alcohol, because they don't allow it here. You can also get a soup if you want. And the interesting thing is the price. It's only 2,000 pesos, $4, and that's hard to beat no matter where you go.
So is the food here any good?
The food here is excellent. I mean, pretty much, because there's no tricks left, you know? Basically, the only display space they have is for their signs, and on the tables, of course. So if your food isn't good, you're not left with any gimmicks or fountains or fancy facades or anything like that. Everybody can see into your kitchen. So you gotta be fast and you gotta be good. There's just no way around it. I think you can get some of the best food in Santiago down here.
So when you bring tourists through here, I see there's a couple pigeons flapping around. There's a dog sitting around on the floor down there. Do people freak out?
I mean, you have all types, right? There's some people who weren't quite expecting that. Maybe when they think of their market, they're thinking of a farmer's market from somewhere in the U.S. or a historic market that's been all redone in other parts of the world. It's a working market. Coming from the U.S., we've really lost our markets. You have, of course, farmer's markets where you can get some on certain days. But as like a functioning part of a society, we're not going to market two or three times a week. Whereas here in Chile, that continues to be the case.
So are there any foods that you can only get here at the either at Tierra Molina or its immediate environment?
There are a few dishes that you're only going to find down here. A lot of those are kind of homemade stuff, like pantrucas, which are just kind of like almost like a dumpling, kind of homemade pasta. You also find stuff like caldo de pata, which is a cow foot soup, you know, and that's served here from early in the morning because it's a way for the people working down here to get that strength, get that, you know, nice gelatiny, strong, thick soup into their system. And then you find these other things that really, that when I see it, I'm always reminded that I'm not back home in Iowa. You know, when there's a guy, there are a couple of guys that they'll sell, they sell actually donkey milk down here. And so you can just walk up, just in there with his donkey, usually have one or two, and they'll have like a little tiny, almost thimble size, and you can get as many little shots of it you want. And he takes it straight from the teat into your cup, down the hatch.
That was Monocle's Chile correspondent Stephen Bodzin being shown around Santiago's market district by local tour guide Colin Bennett. And very jealous we were of him too. You can hear the full report on this week's edition of The Menu, premiering tonight at 1900 hours London time. And you're listening to Midori House. Joe Moran will be here to talk about his new book, Armchair Nation, which traces the rise of a medium that's brought boredom and wonder, irritation and inspiration on a grand scale. That's television, of course, coming up after this.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick. Not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details. And if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 15:41 in Shanghai, 8:41 here in London. And we're delighted to be joined in the studio now by Joe Moran, Professor of Cultural History at Liverpool's John Moores University. His new book, Armchair Nation, discusses the fascinating and surprising history of television in British society and examines the way in which our viewing habits have shaped our identity, both individually and as a nation, in the last 80 years or so.
Joe, TV is pretty ubiquitous. It's something that we all think we know about, but you've come up with this very original and entertaining and fresh look at it. You say in your book that TV is an imperfect attempt to make a human connection across an empty space. What do you mean by that?
I suppose what attracts me about television is just that it is that kind of wordless communication often, and it's very hard to say how it what effect it has. It's just kind of 19 million living rooms, everyone kind of watching it independently, and somehow there's just this kind of intangible form of community that develops just by watching the same programs. And you don't have to, if you watch the same programs, you don't have to agree on anything, you don't have to sign up to a sort of manifesto, but it is a sort of important, I think, and wordless sort of community that's created out of that.
Your book is absolutely full of amazingly interesting facts. For example, you know, the fact that television itself, the word came, was Greco-Latin word, coined in French, borrowed into English, meaning far vision, the idea of sort of seeing something from afar and it being right there. But this idea of community and the fact that it's, you know, people just took to it so far. One of the statistics that I was really interested in was in 1970, 10% of British homes still had no indoor lavatory or bath, 31% had no fridge, 62% had no telephone, but only 8% had no TV. So 92% of all of those households, even in 1970, thought a TV was more important than a loo or a fridge or a bath. The love affair obviously continues, but what does that say about us as a nation?
Yeah. Well, you kind of hear some of the same arguments today about, you know, why are sort of poor families buying these kind of widescreen televisions, why they're kind of wasting their money on that. But actually, I think it sort of makes sense, because if you're not very well off, a television is an incredibly cheap form of entertainment. As once you've bought the TV, once you've paid for the license fee, which I personally think is a bargain for what you get, it's virtually free. So I think it's a way of kind of entering the culture of affluence on the cheap, in a sense. You know, it's if you don't have much else, it's a way of kind of the world entering your living room in that way.
But you talk about it as a force for social cohesion, but is there now so much choice that it's actually become highly individualized and perhaps even alienating in some way?
Well, I suppose that's the sort of paradox of television that people have talked about since it started, really, that it's a force of alienation and also community. You know, it actually brings people together, but it also isolates them, because they're kind of watching it on their own in their living rooms a lot of the time. But I think that one of the things that people said at the start of the digital television era, I think Britain was one of the kind of pioneers in that about 15 years ago, is that television would become a sort of fragmented experience, and that everyone would be watching, you know, whatever they wanted to watch in this kind of multi-channel environment and catching up with it whenever they wanted. And that has happened to a certain extent, but I still think that television is a communal thing. I think that has survived, and I think it's still a sort of collective experience. And actually, quite a lot of the new technology, things like Twitter, you know, with this sort of improvised hashtag that people use to talk about programs, it's created this kind of vast virtual community that for people to talk about the same program. So
the idea of the water cooler moment the next morning in the office has sort of been trumped by Twitter, but still the objective is still there, the impulse to that.
Yeah, and I think that's quite resilient, and I think there are programs that still people want to kind of come together and watch. I think television is a kind of communal experience.
Will that remain the case, though, when you see sort of the rise of things like Netflix or Watch on Demand, so that we're all watching in different ways now? Is there still a sort of the one social experience?
Well, it becomes more difficult, I suppose, and it does change the way people watch. But people have been saying that people would be time shifting and watching things on their own since video came in about 30 years ago. And that sort of happened a bit. It does kind of change people's ways of watching a little bit, but I think there's an awful lot of habit and inertia in the way people watch television. I mean, the interesting thing about what's happened in the industry over the last kind of 30 or 40 years is that all the kind of innovations have not been consumer-led, they've been sort of industry-led. So satellite TV in the late 80s and digital TV in the late 90s, these are things that not necessarily viewers wanted. There wasn't this clamour to have more and more channels. It was something that industry and government wanted, and it's something that viewers have gradually sort of caught up with, I think.
Jo, one of the factoids that I really love in your book is that Claire of Assisi, who supposedly saw from her convent sickbed in Christmas 1252, she supposedly saw midnight mass in the Basilica of St. Francis a few miles away projected onto the wall of her cell. And so many years later, Pope Pius XII declared her to be the patron saint of television, saying that was the first ever TV broadcast. Of all the wonderful facts you uncovered during the research in this book, what was your favourite?
Well, that's quite a good one, actually. But that sort of demonstrates that the idea of television as far vision as actually seeing something kind of instantaneously at the same moment. And I think that was what was exciting about television in the earliest days. A lot of the programmes were actually sound really boring, like, you know, In Signs Through the Ages and kind of lectures about the arterial road system. But actually what people wanted to watch was something happening at the same time somewhere else. And that was the kind of excitement about it.
Jo, finally, who do we become when we watch television?
Well, I don't think we become radically different. I mean, I think people have worried about that for years, you know, that we become zombies or that we'll be corrupted by television. I don't think we change that much. I think it's a kind of source of entertainment. It can be a cure for loneliness. It can be, for a lot of people, it can be a sort of unofficial university. It can be sort of a way of learning about the world. But I don't necessarily think it kind of radically kind of changes who we are.
Let's hope so. Jo Moran, Professor of Cultural History at Liverpool's John Moores University and author of the wonderful Armchair Nation. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on
the
show.
Well, yesterday we were examining the surprise huge US success of the Norwegian pop song What Did the Fox Say? But it's not the first time a duo from Oslo have hit the international charts. From 1986, and with a nod to our previous guest, Jo Moran, here is Aha and The Sun Always Shines on TV.
Thinking has got to be some way to keep my troubles distant. To touch me, how can it be? Believe me, the sun will shine on TV.
The sun always shines on TV, and that comes from the Norwegian group Aha.
Shines on the radio too, at least when we have Thomas Lewis in the studio. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, and it is time at 8:51 for our newspaper review. We are joined, as I mentioned, by our very own Thomas Lewis.
The cherry on the cake, Clemency, is like I like to think myself.
Cherry on the cake. The Welsh cherry. We love it.
Indeed.
Let's start with the Times, shall we? Madeleine police scour thousands of telephone records. That's their lead story this morning.
Yes. So for anyone who's unaware, obviously, wherever you go around the world, there is a criminal case, I think it's fair to say, that becomes the folklore in part of that country. And I think for the United Kingdom, the Madeleine McCann case is certainly one of those. Madeleine McCann was a four-year-old. She went missing in Portugal in May 2000. 2007. Her family were there holidaying. Her parents had gone out with some friends for a meal. They'd been checking on the children in the apartment. And then when her mother went back at 10 p.m., I think, Madeline had gone. Now, fast forward those six, 7 years, and Madeline is still missing. Now, what police are saying today is that they think that European data rules might mean that many of the text messages or the phone calls that were made by the thousands of tourists in that area on May the 3rd in 2007 might actually give them some sort of breakthrough, that actually everyone who made a phone call, everyone who sent a text message, there will be a record of that somewhere. It will be difficult to find. And that legislation was relatively new in 2007, but they do believe that those records are still somewhere, wherever they may be.
Thomas, it seems extraordinary, though, that it's taken this long to look at something that's clearly really important for the case.
Absolutely. Well, that's, I think, what the police in the UK... Now, it's interesting to note that the Prime Minister last year said that there would be an inquiry from the British side into the case itself. Lots of criticism since Madeleine's disappearance into the Portuguese investigations. And yes, they just discovered that there was this black hole, essentially, that this data did exist and that it had never been pursued and that it had never been followed through on. So they are hoping, after all this time and after all of these dead ends and suspicion has fallen on various people, her parents even were believed to be suspects right back at the start. They were cleared in 2008, that, you know, hopefully this might bring us a little bit closer to know exactly what happened to Madeleine McCann.
The Detective Chief Inspector investigating this, though, has said it's unrealistic to expect to track down every last person, that 99% of the phone numbers are likely to belong to completely unaware and innocent individuals. They will, in some cases, much as the sympathy for the McCann family is obviously, you know, enormous in public opinion, there will be people who say, you know, she was just one of very many children who go missing every single year. And there's a huge amount of resources and, you know, taxpayers' money that have already been dedicated to this. Why does she get that? I know that's a tough line, but
it
I'm
is
just
a tough
calling
line.
Devil's advocate. There will be some people who I'm sure will feel that.
And then you're almost sort of casting the question on to, say, the media or commentators and say, why do some cases gain more prominence than others? And for some reason, this is a terrible, terrible case. And her parents have become very public figures in those years since she vanished. And they've led a very public campaign. Obviously, other parents who've been through this terrible situation decide to take another route. But the McCanns, Jerry and Kate, they, for a long, long time, have been very public faces in trying to track down their daughter. I think, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that this is a huge undertaking. We're talking about 2007. We're talking about thousands of numbers, thousands of text messages. Needle in a haystack is a pretty appropriate way of probably describing it. But I think, you know, this case is such a big part of, has been such a big part of public discourse in the UK, if you like, that actually I think people are willing to give it a shot.
I mean, it seems too much to hope that she's still alive, but at least it would be cathartic, I suppose, if something does. Cathartic for the nation as well as for the poor, poor family. Thomas, let's move on now to a story that's absolutely really taken over the Conservative Party conference, which we would have expected to have been reading about in the British papers at the moment. But instead, it's all about the Labour Party and the Milibands.
Yes, it is. Now, the Milibands and the Labour Party, they had their party conference just before the Conservatives did. And that was overshadowed by these revelations about Gordon Brown and the government he ran back then, which was something that Ed Miliband, I think, was pretty annoyed about. But this is really a story that's been dominating the headlines here in the UK. Ed Miliband, the Labour leader. A newspaper, the Daily Mail, published a weekend article saying that his father, who is a very prominent left-wing thinker, hated Britain. And this caused a really huge debate. Ed Miliband went very big on this and wrote a criticism and a response the following day, I believe, which then the Mail itself decided to publish yet another reinforcement of its stance right next to that apology. So it's turned into this very, very big debate. There are debates whether Ed Miliband is taking this as a sort of a political opportunity. Many people, many commentators believe he's doing that.
Although he's maintained that he's acting as a son, not as a politician.
Absolutely. I was about to say he gave an interview to the BBC not that long ago in which he said exactly those words. And I think, you know, it's interesting now that the owner of the papers, Lord Rothermere, has now apologised. So I'm sure many of Ed Miliband's
supporters...
But that's
not because of the Ralph Miliband story. That's because they sent two reporters from the Mail on Sunday to a private
wake or a private memorial service for Ed Miliband's uncle.
That's right.
On the 29th floor of a hospital where he was a very eminent doctor, where he died this year.
That's right. And as you say, these reporters went in there, started asking family members apparently what they thought about this original article. Now, for any family in grief, any family wanting to remember a loved one, whoever they may be, it's a pretty intrusive act. Now, the paper itself, Lord Rothermere, the owner, have said that essentially this was as a rogue act, that was not sanctioned by the paper itself. Ed Miliband has come out and said, I don't believe it. And I think that actually, Lord Rothermere, you need to look at your practices at your paper. This is something that isn't that strange, really, for papers like yours. Now, Lord Rothermere hasn't yet commented on that point specifically. But I think the fact that he has apologised will be seen as a victory of sorts for Ed Miliband, I think, in this very public row.
Although the editor, Paul Dacre, has not. I mean, he's...
And also the editor, Paul Dacre, let's not forget, is the chairman of the Press Complaints Commission. So it's not as if Labour can go to the PCC on this, even though they received 726 complaints about this article when it came out.
And Paul Dacre was very close to Ed Miliband's predecessor, Gordon Brown, as well. So it does get very murky there. And I think actually Ed Miliband, if we want to talk about the PCC for a second, has said actually there's no point in me sending it there because it's a shambles of an organisation, essentially. So yes, I mean, on the face of it, I think Ed Miliband may have won this small victory for now.
We've almost got time just to slip in a little thing about breakfast.
Well, it is
breakfast.
All
we can say
time.
Is that porridge is making a comeback.
And yes,
if you're in a time zone in which you're eating breakfast, we hope you're eating porridge.
Indeed.
Sadly, that is all we have time for today. Thank you very much, Thomas Lewis. Thanks also to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Matt Alagaya. Our studio manager today was Bill Luthi. Up next after the news is Monocle's design programme, Section D, with Tom Morris.
And Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn will be back with Midori House at the same time on Monday. But from us, Georgina Godwin
and Clemency Burton Hill, thanks
goodbye.
For listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.